What we have to do is change our mindset. We put a boundary on ourselves so that we reduce the access that we grant that person to our limited areas of capacity. I'm not supposed to control another person, but I am responsible to control me.
I want you to imagine that you are sitting down, not opposite me, you're sitting down opposite your 21-year-old self. What would you say to her?
Oh, that's such a good question. I would say that there's going to be a lot of life that happens, and you're going to have a choice to either look at the circumstances and try to determine from the lens of those circumstances if God is faithful, or you can keep your eyes on the Lord and remember God is good even when he doesn't feel good. God is good to you, and God is good at being God. You don't have to carry the weight of all that you're going to face by yourself. And if you look through that lens, that God is good to me, and God is good at being God, then your circumstances will be kept in perspective so much better.
I love that. God is good at being God.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Well, I think too many times in my life, I have tried to carry the weight of all that I'm facing, and I work my emotions into a tangled fray, and I work my fingers to the bone trying to figure it out or fix it. But, you know, some of the most powerful scriptures that I've clung to, especially the past 10 years, come from Mark chapter 14. And it's right when Jesus, right before he's about to go to the cross, and his prayer is so almost brutally honest to the Lord, where he says, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." And when I hear those words, I think about this. Jesus, because he was perfect divinity and full humanity, he was sinless, but he was very much sinned against. So Jesus had access to all the answers. He knew it all. And yet, even having all the answers, his soul still cried out that he was overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. And so Jesus had the answers, and it didn't fix his sorrow. So I could spend my whole life seeking out answers to why this happened and, you know, what good is possibly going to come from it ever. I could seek those answers, or I could just simply trust the Lord in that moment and just say, "Lord, you are good. You are good to me, and you are good at being God. So therefore, I don't have to carry that weight."
I don't think I've ever heard anybody express that one particular thing of Jesus had all the answers, but he was still in anguish. That's huge.
Well, it was huge for me because I'm a girl that likes to take all the facts and try to figure it out. And I feel like if I can figure it out, then I can get through it. But that's kind of the opposite of faith, you know? Yeah. If it's only dependent on what I can see and what I can do and what I can figure out, then that's not really me stepping into the faith that will really get me through what I'm walking through.
Before we dive into your new book, which, by the way, I love. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Typical Lisa, vulnerable and full of hope. That's how I always find your books, vulnerable and full of hope. Full of pain, honest, transparent pain, and yet this redemptive suffering. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that, I want you to take us back, because I don't think I know that much about your childhood. Mm. What was your family like growing up?
Well, my mom had me when she was very young. She was only 19 when she got pregnant with me. And she got married at 18, got pregnant with me at 19. And my biological father was shipped off to Korea. And so my mom and I lived in a single wide trailer with plastic furniture. And we still laugh about that to this day. And she was my whole world, and I was her whole world. As a matter of fact, when I was 6 months old, my mom decided, I'm not into these cloth diapers anymore. So she decided to potty train me.
And 6 months?
6 months. I have pictures to prove it, because I know that sounds so strange, but she did. And that was that. Those were those early years, those really formative years. But it was such a blessing to have a mom that loved me and adored me and treasured me and told me every day what a gift I was to her. Because that was not the case with my biological father. He never wanted children, and he made it really clear. And when he came home, he was only home for, you know, just a few short years, and things went really sideways between he and my mom. My mom was about to leave him, and she found out she was pregnant with my sister. So we stayed in kind of a environment that was full of turmoil. And then eventually my mom did leave him and divorce him. And when my dad left my mom, he left us too. And at that point, I was probably 9 or 10 years old. And my mom had to go out and work several jobs just to make ends meet. And so I have this vivid memory of sitting at the kitchen table one morning before she went to work, and she slid this pile of bills over and the checkbook over. And she said, "Lisa, you're gonna have to figure this out because I can't." And so
then— You're 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so then I had to figure out what bills to pay and what bills to hold and how long we could hold certain things so that our water wouldn't get cut off, and I had to balance the checkbook and all of that. And, you know, I did it. And my mom and I, again, we worked as a team and we got through those years. Then in later in middle school, my mom remarried a wonderful man, and he really became a father figure to us. And then they started having more children. And so I had my sister, they had my sister, Sarah. My mom went into labor with my sister, Sarah, on my 15th birthday.
Wow.
And then she had my sister, Haley, when I was 18. And Haley was just like my baby. And she was very, very precious to me. But tragically, when I went off to college at 16 months, Haley got really, really sick and passed away. And it was one of those seasons where I thought that I could make a deal with God. If you'll just save Haley, then I promise you, I will love you, I'll serve you. But in my mind, that meant I'll follow your rules. And so I felt like I had kept up my end of the bargain, but God did not. And so I turned my back on God and just said, forget it, I'm not doing life your way. And so college was full of ups and downs. Even when I graduated college, I just kept trying to seek happiness my own way. And eventually I found a guy that said that he loved me and kind of said all the things that my biological father never did. And we were dating, and then I found out I was pregnant. And my mom was still going through so much grief over losing Haley. And I was terrified that I just felt very alone and terrified. So I made the really tragic choice to have an abortion. And that's really what brought me to my knees. And I'll never forget the emotional pain from that decision sent me into such a spiral. And then one day I really did just cry out to the Lord, and I just said, I don't know what I'm saying yes to, but I need you. And so I say yes to you, Lord. And pretty much my life has been a series of continuing to say yes to God since then.
What would you say to someone who's listening and watching and thinking, even if there is a God? I remember it happened with our son, who was 5, and my father-in-law lived with us for a couple of years, and Christian and I were the only two home the night that he died. And I saw in the days that passed, Christian went from grief to anger. And I remember asking him about that, and he said, I asked God to save my papa, and he didn't. So it's not that I don't believe there is a God. I think there might be, but I don't like him, and I'm not going to talk to him anymore. What do you say to somebody who feels like, because here's the two things. We believe that God is all powerful, and we believe that God is love. So if you're all powerful, don't let this little one die. If you're just love, then you wouldn't. So that means you're not all powerful.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
First of all, I would say I understand. And I think your feelings are valid. Of course we would feel that way, right? And then going back to Mark 14, where Jesus is in the garden, right after he prays that his soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Going a little further, he prays this, God, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. In other words, God, you are capable of anything. So don't let this be my story. Don't let this be the way things go. Take it away from me. And I just think, what a gift Jesus gave us, that, again, Jesus knew the plan, and he knew that it was for good. He knew everything on this earth was temporary. He knew that it's eternity that's going to be forever. He knew all of that. And he still said to God, God, everything is possible for you, so change the plan. That's so mind-blowing to me. But just like we see in Hebrews 2, there's two reasons that Jesus came. He came to make atonement for our sin, but he also came to be a merciful and faithful high priest. In other words, he came so that he could feel the weight of humanity, the grit, the grime, and the grief of humanity. And I believe he wants us to really look at what he did next. So he prays, like, take this cup from me, change the plan, don't make this be the way the story goes. Just like I'm sure Christian prayed over your father, and I prayed over so many circumstances in my life. I don't want this to be the way my story goes. But then Jesus utters these 9 earth-shaking, hell-shattering, demon-quaking words, yet not what I will, but what you will, God. And so often in my morning prayers, I will pray, God, you are good. God, you are good to me. And God, you are good at being God. And right behind that, I say, after I make all my suggestions, you know, we have so many suggestions. And I honestly think some of my suggestions are really, really good. But I have a moment where I sit with the Lord and I say, okay, all of that. And I'm going to trade my will for thy will, because I'm so confident you will, God. And I don't have to see how it's going to work out. And I don't have to know all of the answers. I'm sure with all of your heart, you still wish that your dad wouldn't have passed away. I still wish with all of my heart, the past 10 years of my life wouldn't have gone the direction that it went. And yet, I do know that God is trustworthy. And in the physical realm of all the pain that we see, that is absolutely true. We are experiencing real pain. But at the same time, with God, there's always a meanwhile. Meanwhile, this is all true, and what God is working out for good is also true. And those two are operating at the same time.
I love that you brought up the Mark 14 passage, because for me, how it's helped me is I think Jesus processed his pain in the presence of his Father. Because sometimes, you know, when we're going through tough stuff, we're either trying to fix it ourselves, or we're trying to shove it down into the cellar of our souls, or we're trying a million and one things. But the fact that Jesus actually processed that agony,
yes,
open-handed in the presence of his Father. And I think when we do that, when we tell the truth, we make space for grace. Because mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I have seen throughout your life as long as I've known you. I mean, the tragedy of a little one, one that you considered almost like, this is my little
yes.
girl. Then the tragedy of the abortion, which I'm sure broke your heart into a million pieces. Now, if that was the end, if we could just write a book now and say, and then Lisa lived happily ever after. But that's not been true. You've gone through so much heartache. When you graduated from college, how did you imagine your life? What did you think you would be doing?
Well, I thought I would marry the guy that I dated in college. And I thought that we would have these children that I had imagined, you know. I think the hard thing about a woman is we don't just look forward to the future, we make plans as if the future is already real. So I had already named my kids, you know, that I would have with them. I already imagined our home, everything. And then when that relationship fell apart, I not only grieved the loss of the relationship, but I grieved the children that I would never have. And I grieved the vision of what I thought my life would look like. I think coming out of that, then I just thought, now what? Like, what do I do now? And so then I decided, okay, well, maybe I'll just be a career woman. So I jumped right into a career. And that was wonderful, until also that was not wonderful. And I think I look back now and I see that I was very attached to outcomes of my own making. I kind of had this checklist thing, like, I know what will make me happy. It's to get married, have kids, have, you know, the cute little house with the minivan parked out front. Maybe not the minivan, but that was part of the dream. And then, an amazing career. And I think what I quickly realized is when we attach our hope to outcomes of our own making, we're setting ourselves up to possibly get epically disappointed, because really there's nothing in this world that we can attach our hope to and have it be permanently wonderful.
There's thousands and thousands and thousands of women, not just here in the States, but around the world, who are profoundly grateful for the ministry that you head up, Proverbs 31. How did you go from, I'm going to be a career woman, to suddenly Proverbs 31 woman? That seems like quite a leap.
It was quite a leap, because I eventually did get married, and then right away got pregnant and had a little baby. And now all of a sudden I was a stay-at-home mom, and that was amazing, except I still did have this drive inside of me to do something. And so I was trying everything. I remember I went and took some classes to learn how to arrange flowers, and I thought, great, I'll open up my own floral shop, and that didn't work. And then I thought, okay, now I'm gonna sell cooking utensils. So I sold cooking utensils, but in one of the demonstrations I was doing, I was telling them how safe the slicer dicer was, and I cut off the end of one of my fingers, and so I was like, yeah, this
sales plummeted in that company.
So this is probably not supposed to be my career. But then one day, a gal approached me and said she was starting a little newsletter to encourage other stay-at-home moms, and she wanted to know if I would help her. And I said, yes, I'll do the marketing, but I don't ever want to say anything up front. I don't ever want to, you know, be up front in any way. I'll just work behind the scenes. And so that's how it started. It was just this little newsletter that people, really friends and family, would send us $15 a year, and they would get 12 newsletters over that year. And that's how the whole thing started.
And then exploded, clearly.
And it did, yeah.
I did a survey recently. I asked our team at TBN, would you give me a list of why people call in for prayer? I wanted to know, like, what are the, particularly the last 2 or 3 years, which have just been so bizarre, so many people are lonely, devastated. But I wanted to know, what do people call in for prayer about? And I found out that a vast majority of the people are calling in because they're having marital problems. And I think the COVID epidemic exacerbated that, because suddenly people were home together a lot when things were, I mean, Barry and I have been married for 28 years, and I almost killed him during COVID, which I still think might have been technically legal during COVID, because he wakes up talking. I mean, he just talks, and I like quiet in the morning. All of that to say, when did you, who always have this idea of how life is going to be, when did you begin to think things were not going well in your marriage?
It was in 2013, and you know, at first I could pin it to other things. You know, we had 5 children, and so that's a very busy household. And some of our kids were, you know, graduating, going off to college. And so I just at first attribute it to there's lots of transition happening, and, you know, sometimes it's hard. And then, you know, my ex-husband was experiencing, you know, a birthday, a significant birthday. And so I thought, well, maybe it's just that he's kind of hit that place where he's feeling like he's getting, you know, older than he would like to be or whatever. So I always had things that I could attribute what I was feeling and sensing to that were a whole lot less severe than what was actually happening. And I didn't find out for sure what was happening. I got through 2013, 2014, 2015. But I knew just there was something, it was like an undercurrent of turmoil that that I wasn't used to, and that made me very, very, very anxious. And at the same time, I think he was trying to convince me that I was the crazy one. And so every time I would ask questions, you know, he would just say things like, you know, Lisa, we really need to like work on your mental health and stuff. And so I now know that the counseling term for that is gaslighting. I didn't know it then. And then in early 2016, the day of my oldest daughter's rehearsal dinner, I found out for sure that he was having an affair. I really do think that my body just went into shutdown mode. I knew I had to get through the wedding for my daughter, and so I did, but I was in a complete fog. I was smiling on the outside while I was screaming on the inside, just desperate to wake up and have this all be a bad dream. But it wasn't, it was real.
Not only that, but it wasn't something he was willing to walk away from. Where is God in all, because I'm thinking of people who are thinking right now, yeah, that is my story. Where is God when he's not answering your prayers in a way that makes sense?
Well, it's a lot easier for me to answer that question now. If you would have interviewed me that day, I would have said, I have no idea where God is, you know? And I think it's okay to be that honest and that terrified and that broken. But here's what I know to be absolutely true. We don't serve a do-nothing God. God is always doing something, and that something is always pointed in the direction of good. And I could not see the good in that season. It was impossible for me to see the good in that season. But what I could do is trace God's hand of faithfulness behind me. And I could remember other circumstances where God was good, circumstances I didn't know how I was going to get out of. And so that didn't fully comfort me, but it did remind me that I may not see the hand of God moving in the way that I think it should. But that doesn't mean God isn't moving. It just may mean he's doing something different. And what I was so desperate for was for God's hand to move in a direction of complete reconciliation between me and my husband. But instead, God's hand was moving, but it became a rescue, and he rescued me out. And I do think sometimes God rescues us out of relationships. Sometimes God, you know, creates a reconciliation opportunity. But for that reconciliation to take place, both people have to work toward reconciliation. There has to be repentance. There has to be a complete turnaround. The behavior that got into, you know, got you into that brokenness cannot be the behavior that will get you out of it, you know? And I remember the day that I got the divorce papers from my attorney, and I didn't know what emotion to have at that point. Sure. You know, it's like, do I cry? Do I thank God for rescuing me out? Do I grieve the loss of a nearly 30-year marriage? And the answer is yes, all of the above.
I've often wondered, because I know what the Christian community can be like. You know, we can be incredibly supportive and understanding, and we can be brutal with one another. I remember posting a comment on Instagram one day, a fairly insipid comment, simply saying that it was the day when Joe Biden's son, Beau, finally passed from his cancer. And being a mom of just one boy, it broke my heart. And all I posted was, praying today for the Biden family. I got annihilated online by believers saying, you know, this is, how can you pray for a man like that? And I'm like, it kind of blew my mind. But I've often wondered for you, you know, we have these things within the church where these are the regular sins that we all do. And these are the big no-nos.
Right.
So how did you navigate those waters of people who hold you in such high esteem, believing that you shouldn't have got divorced?
Well, it wasn't easy, you know. I mean, I was already suffering so much heartbreak on my own. And then to add on top of that, you know, people, well-meaning people, but people putting pressure on me. Lisa, if you get a divorce, you're basically giving permission to a whole generation of women to also divorce their husbands. And I just thought, well, first of all, I'm not that powerful. Second of all, I'm absolutely not giving permission to anyone. And third of all, I am just trying to survive a story that I didn't want. I didn't want this divorce. I didn't see it coming, and there was nothing that I could do to change him. If I had power to change another person, I would have. Yeah. But all I had to do was, you know, all I could do was to save myself and save my sanity. And, you know, I did a lot of research around what helps kids be resilient after something as tragic as a divorce. And the research shows that the number one thing that can help a child be resilient past a divorce, especially an unwanted divorce like mine was, is to have one healthy, stable parent. And if I wanted to be healthy and I wanted to be stable, then I could no longer participate in the dysfunction that was going to take both of us out if I didn't get out.
You mentioned we have 5 children and 2 are adopted. Am I correct in that? 2
yeah.
Darling boys are adopted. How do you help your children in that process? Because I think it's something that, it's the same as, you know my story. My story is to do more with mental illness, which doesn't just impact me, it impacts our family, it impacts my husband, it impacts our son. And I was trying to think, what would that have been like for you in the midst of your own overwhelming grief? Because what people probably don't understand is the years that you tried, the year after year of extended grace and forgiveness. How do you help your children? What do you say to them when they don't understand?
I think when the trauma is not just one trauma, but it's over and over and over, and it's this trauma and then that trauma and then this one, and my kids were of the age where it's not like I could sort of hide some of the impact of all of this from them. And so, unfortunately, they were knee-deep in the trauma with me, not because I pulled them in there, but because they were very aware of what was going on. And so I don't know that I did it all right, but I can tell you a couple of things that I did right. And one is I made a commitment to my kids that if they had questions, I would answer them truthfully. But I also made a commitment to them that I wouldn't continue to talk about things beyond what their questions needed. And they even asked me as a very healthy boundary. They said, please don't talk about our dad unless we ask you questions. And, you know, I think part of that is I could get a divorce, but they were not in that situation, you know, that they can't divorce their dad. And so I respected that boundary, and I think that was a really good, healthy thing. So I don't know that I did it all right, but I would say those conversations were important. And also getting good counseling and making that available to my kids so that they didn't always feel like they had to process it amongst themselves or process it with me, that they could go in a neutral environment and someone who was trained with how to heal from trauma. Giving them access to that was really important too.
How did you deal with the anger? Because I was trying, which is impossible, to put myself in your place, knowing some of the behind the, you know, story details of how awful it was at times. What do you do with that? Or were you angry? Or were you more grief-stricken? But how do you handle that?
I think I was shocked. That was my primary emotion. And I remember going into my counselor and I kept saying, I just can't believe this. And then I just can't believe this. And then the next week, I just can't believe it. And finally my counselor says, really? You can't believe it? Because pretty much this has been a pattern now where I think you should believe it. And he helped ease me to the place where I understood mental health as a commitment to reality at all costs. Wow. And so part of my struggle was I wanted to and I needed to feel all the feelings for sure. But I also knew that while those feelings could indicate things that I needed to address, I didn't want them to dictate how I suddenly lived my life. And so I could feel angry, and boy, did I feel angry sometimes. But I didn't have to live as an angry person. Easier said than done, obviously. And I would give myself lots and lots of grace for certain moments that it was just a flood of emotion and that was it. But I also knew from almost the very beginning of this, that it was not going to be something I could get over. It was something that I was going to have to walk through. Yeah. And there were not going to be any shortcuts. And, you know, I'm thankful that I had wise people around me to give me some really crucial nuggets of advice that were very, very important. And one was my counselor, his name is Jim Kress, he's amazing. But he one time said, Lisa, a sign of true healing is that you can go home and sit in the quiet alone with your own thoughts and be okay. And I really did not like that answer because I thought that's the last thing I want to do is go home and sit alone with my thoughts. But it was absolutely important because it allowed me space to identify what I was really feeling. And those feelings became pointers of the healing that needed to take place. And so those feelings were like the indicator lights on a dashboard. Yeah. And I had to be committed that what I was walking through, this really was as bad as what I thought it was. And these feelings were real. And I didn't want to get swept away with the feelings, but I definitely wanted to pay attention to them because we have to feel the pain if we're ever going to be able to deal with the pain. And we have to deal with the pain if we're ever going to heal from the pain.
And so from that place, one of the phrases that I always think of when I think of you and your journey is I believe that you have, and honestly it brings tears to my eyes, that you have stewarded your suffering well. There's a difference between walking through suffering and stewarding your suffering. You have allowed the Lord to take the very things that have broken you and you have lifted them up and you have allowed God's love to flow through these broken places to other women. And for that, on behalf of everyone, thank you. So now we have this new book and it's called Good Boundaries and Goodbyes, Loving Others Without Losing the Best of Who You Are. First of all, would you just help us understand, how do you define, what is a boundary?
Well, thank you for your sweet words too, Sheila. I appreciate you saying that. That has been my prayer to steward well. And honestly, this book is part of that because a boundary, I think sometimes we think of boundaries as an attempt to shove another person away or to control another person who seems a little bit out of control or to fix an issue that we know needs to be fixed, but we can't figure out exactly how to communicate it. And so it's just like, okay, well then let me just create a separation with this person so I don't really have to deal with what's the real issue here. That's not a boundary. A boundary is a wonderful communication tool for us to establish what is and is not okay in that relationship, what we do and what we do not have to give in that relationship, and what we can and cannot tolerate in that relationship. Now, obviously, we need to check ourselves because sometimes we can just be selfish, you know, and like, I don't have that to give, you know, well, that's great. It's Christmas morning and there's a pile of dishes. I'm sorry that you don't have that to give, but we all need to participate, right? That may or may not have been a boundary that one of my children tried to draw with me. But I think the boundary is this opportunity for us to communicate so we avoid extremes. The extreme over here is that somebody's doing something and it's creating a lot of wear and tear in the relationship. It's making me feel worn down and worn out. And so over here, I take it and I take it and I take it and I take it and I take it. Until one day I jump to the other extreme and say, I just can't take it anymore. I'm done. So a boundary helps us bring things back to the middle and avoid extremes where we learn how to communicate effectively, like I said, what is and is not acceptable, what we do and do not have to give. And when we do it and we do it in healthy ways, the boundary actually should be a way that we can fight for our relationships to stay healthy.
I can imagine a lot of Christian women. In fact, when I spent a month in a psych hospital, I talked to some women like this who believed one woman had been so severely physically abused by her husband. He'd broken her jaw, he'd broken her leg. I mean, she'd been through so much, but she believed if she drew a boundary, you know, and stepped away even for a time, that that was not the Christian thing to do. Why do you think we get so confused as believers? Because you say in your book, boundaries are not, that's not our idea. Boundaries are God's idea.
Well, one scripture I like to point out that there's many scriptures that I think can kind of feed this notion of like, is it okay to draw a boundary? But one of them is where Jesus teaches us and models that we are to lay down our life for our friends, right? And Jesus did do that. He did lay down his life for other people, for all of us. But Jesus laid down his one life to accomplish a high and holy purpose. Jesus did not lay down his life to enable bad behavior to continue. And so I think we must not confuse the good command to love with the bad behavior of enabling choices that really are not going to benefit either one of you. You know, I think sometimes we can get caught in this dysfunctional dance where we get afraid, if I draw a boundary, then this person is going to take something from me that I don't want them to take. So instead of drawing the boundary, I just deal with the pain of whatever the behavior is. Maybe it's because I'm afraid if I draw a boundary, they're going to reject me, or they're going to be epically disappointed in me, or they're going to walk away from me. Well, the thing is, if by drawing a healthy boundary, if that's the kind of person that would have the reaction to reject you, walk away from you, just be disappointed in you, then chances are they're going to be those things, whether you draw the boundary or not. So our job isn't to control them. Our job is to keep ourselves self-controlled and stable and sane in the process. God never called us to control other people, but the evidence, one fruit of the evidence of God's Spirit in us is self-control. And so I think it's important that we understand, we draw the boundaries so that we can remain in control despite how out of control another person gets.
Are boundaries appropriate in families with, like, say with your children? You know, some of the comments I got recently when I asked a question, what's the hardest thing you're dealing with right now and how can Barry and I pray for you, was, you know, my kids are totally out of control. You know, I raised them to go to church, they don't care anymore. How do you apply good boundaries with children?
Well, we have to always think about age appropriateness, and we do have a responsibility as a parent. It's not like, okay, I'm going to draw this boundary, and so because you refuse to clean your dishes at night, I'm no longer going to provide food for you. You know, I mean, that's probably not going to work because you do have the responsibility to care well for your children. But I do think that age appropriately, letting your children suffer the consequences of their choices is so much better than you stepping in and saying, don't do this, but then rescuing them from the consequences of that choice. Because if they never feel the consequences of their own choices, then they're not going to have the appropriate self-motivation to change their behavior. You know, I like to think of it like this. Like if you and I were here today and one of us had a cardiac event, the other one surely would jump in and do CPR. Right. And using external pressure, I could sustain your life for a little while, right? But at some point, if your heart does not beat and quicken and just start to pump on its own, I can't permanently sustain your life using external pressure trying to get your heart to change. You're going to be super frustrated if you just try to put a boundary on them to force them to change. What we have to do is change our mindset. We put a boundary on ourselves so that we reduce the access that we grant that person to our limited areas of capacity. I'm not supposed to control another person, but I am responsible to control me.
Wow. I wrote down a quote and I want to make sure I get it right. Yeah, I love this. And this is what you were kind of touching on. You say love can be unconditional, but relational access never should be. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, again, when I was reading through the Bible, asking the question, is God okay with boundaries? Which, by the way, God established the foundations of the world in Genesis 1 by separating, in other words, creating boundaries between light and darkness, dry land and the water, right? And then we get into Genesis 2. Of all the topics that God could have chosen to be the subject matter of the first conversation recorded between God and man, God chose the topic of a boundary. And he said, you're free to eat from all these trees in the garden, but you must not eat from this one tree or else you will die. And so by the time I kept studying, is God okay with boundaries? By the time I got to the way that God establishes the temple, God gives certain people certain access in the temple, but not all people all access. And it wasn't because he loved this group of people more than this group of people. It's that he required different levels of responsibility. Wow. And so the more access you were granted, the more responsibility that you had to demonstrate to have that kind of access. The greatest access was given to the high priest once a year to go into the Holy of Holies. But that high level of access required a very high level of responsibility, or else the priest, if he wasn't perfectly cleansed and had on the right garments and all the stuff, then he would drop dead. He would suffer the greatest consequence. And so those two words really grabbed my attention: access and responsibility. Here's where I was getting it wrong. I was giving level 10 access to people without requiring level 10 responsibility. Now, when I say access, I mean access to my areas of limited capacity. I have limited time capacity, financial capacity, relational capacity, energy capacity, right? So I've got limited areas of capacity, not because I'm selfish, but because I'm human. Only God has unlimited capacity.
Yeah.
And when we try to act like we have unlimited capacity, we're actually trying to act like we're God, and we're not. And so we're already doing this really well in some areas of our life. Like, we know if we give level 10 access to all people by handing out our financial information, you know, like today, if I said, Sheila, what's your bank account number and what's your passcode? You would probably say back to me, I'm not sharing that, right?
Probably, yes.
Why? Is it because you're unchristian?
No.
No. It's because what? You have limited finances in your bank account. So you cannot give level 10 access to your bank account unless you make sure people demonstrate level 10 responsibility to have that kind of access. So here's where I was getting it wrong. I was giving level 10 access. They were only bringing level 3 responsibility. I can have a conversation asking them to be more responsible, but if they are unwilling or incapable, trying to force them to be more responsible with the external pressure of putting a boundary on them, it's not going to work. So I put the boundary on myself, and I reduce the access I grant them down to level 3, which is their demonstrated level of responsibility.
Wow. What would you say to somebody who's listening in? And I mean, I remember the first time I read Henry Cloud's book, Changes That Heal. It was like these bells were going off inside of me, like, you know, warning, red flags. What would you say to somebody who's going to read Good Boundaries and Goodbyes to even know where to start? Because it's kind of scary if you've never lived that way.
It is. Well, first of all, I would say I have a lot of scripts in the book. And these aren't just hard and horrific things. You know, these are going to really help save your sanity. So one example is, we all get requests, and we see this request come up, and we think, oh, inside my heart, inside my gut, I know I should say no. But then suddenly my mouth says yes. Or suddenly I type yes, of course, you know. And so that's a good way to practice boundaries, when you know something is a no, because again, you have limited capacity. You can check yourself. Am I saying no because I'm being selfish?
Yeah.
So if you're being selfish, then yeah, maybe adjust. But if it's because you're being honest about your limitations, here's a simple script. While my heart says yes, 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 the reality of my time makes this a no. Thank you for understanding.
That's excellent, and I will be using that a lot in the future.
Just don't really, use it on me, right?
Never on you, never, never, never.
Yeah.
But really, think of the number of people who end up doing things and actually really resenting it, because the answer should have been no, but they felt, this person will like me more if I say yes. And usually it doesn't end up that way. They don't like you more. They just got, you know, what they needed from you.
Right. Or we say yes because, again, we may be concerned, what will this person take from me if I say no? And whatever it is that we're getting from them, maybe it's support, maybe it's being liked by them, maybe it's, you know, accolades or attaboys or whatever, you know, opportunity. So us saying no to that person, I think sometimes makes us afraid they're gonna take from us whatever they're giving to us that we feel we have to have. And so here's the way that I would think about it. Is it possible that too many of us are desperately wanting from other people things that we really should be getting from the Lord? Yeah. Like, I think I will always desperately want things from other people in those exact areas that I fear God will not provide for me. And so then it's hard for me to say no, because then I lose control of that situation, right? And I think the other part of this that we have to think about is just take a step back from it all. And if I were to say, okay, Sheila, pull out your journal today, and on one side write, this is who Sheila is when she's at her best, when she's balanced, she's got enough sleep, you know, she's really paid attention to her limited capacity, and she's not hyperextending or bankrupting her capacity. So what does Sheila look like? She's amazingly kind. She is generous. She's loving. She's interested in other people. So you would list all these great qualities because you have so many. But then I would challenge you, okay, Sheila, on the other side of the page, write down what Sheila looks like when she's worn out, worn down, frazzled, or fractured.
Ask my husband.
But, you know,
I know so what you're saying.
These yeah. two different versions of ourselves. Now ask the question, which version of myself do I want to be front and center in my life? Well, I want to be the best version of myself. Therefore, I'm responsible to make sure that I don't get into a position where I'm giving so much or sacrificing so much that I get bitter and resentful and angry and withdrawn, or whatever those qualities are that are the worst versions of ourselves. That's what it means to draw a boundary, not to shove other people away, but it's so that we can love others well without losing the best of who we are.
I love that. That is so helpful. So let's just get to the other bit, good boundaries and goodbyes. When do we know it's time to say goodbye to something or someone in our life?
Well, I always say take steps, not leaps.
Yeah, I love you said that.
You know, obviously, if you're in physical danger, then you need to get away right away. But if it's a scenario where it's a process to get to this goodbye, just take steps. And one appropriate step is to get a board of directors around you. And that doesn't mean that you have to have an organization. I have a personal board of directors. And these are people in my life that can speak truth to me. They can walk beside me. They know the depth of the struggles that I've been through, and they can help me think biblically. And I can borrow some of their wisdom when I feel like I'm shaky in my own, or I can borrow some of their faith when I feel like my faith is really getting worn down right now, or whatever it is. But these people, and it doesn't have to be 10 people, it could be just a few people, but it includes a friend of mine who knows the Bible inside and out, and who can help me dig into scriptures and find the answers that I need. And then it also includes my therapist, Jim Kress. It's really, really important.
His wisdom throughout the book is incredible.
Yes, I thought that was gonna be absolutely crucial to have that. And then two dear friends that walk, they do life with me every day. I cannot hide from them. They are aware of me, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, what I'm going through from the morning, early in the morning to late at night. We all have each other, we track each other, you know, so we all have our locations and everything. So these are like dear, dear friends. And so this group of people really help me when I have to make the harder decisions. And, you know, that's one reason I started Therapy and Theology, the podcast that we do, is because maybe you don't have access to a friend who can give you Bible answers to some of your deep questions, or maybe you don't have a therapist yet. Well, the podcast that I started with a theologian and my own therapist helps provide that for people until they can possibly find a therapist on their
How
own.
How do people find that podcast? Is that simply
it's
what it's
anywhere,
called?
Yep, it's called Therapy and Theology with Lisa Turker. So anywhere podcasts are, you can find it.
Oh, I love that. Because honestly, I so agree with that. I have three women in my life that I call my safe sisters. Mm-hmm. And it was really life-saving during when the first year of COVID. You know, at first I actually thought it was great because I stayed in my pajamas all day and watched the Great British Baking Show, you know, until we started doing
it. I watched that too.
Oh, gosh. But then I found myself spiraling again with depression. And we have this thing that we get on these Zoom calls with each other because I've tried to move it to phone calls so that I don't have to care what my face looks like. And they're like, nope, get on the Zoom call. We want to look in your eyes. And there were several times during those months when I'd be like, you know what, girls, I'm not joining today. And they were like, Sheila, sit down in the chair and hit this button now. Mm-hmm. And really it's, and part of it was them reminding me of what's always true, mm-hmm. no matter what might be true for a moment. Mm. So I cannot endorse what you said more highly. It's so important because the enemy looks for who he can devour. I remember when I was in Africa watching these beautiful gazelles and impala, and they would be just racing together as a team. And then one evening when we're coming back from something, there's one by itself, which is something I've never seen. And we stopped the Jeep, and I asked the guy who was our guide, why is he standing all by himself? Why is he not moving? And he said, you need to look over in that bush. And I look over, and there's a lion. And within seconds, that darling little animal was taken out. And the irony is that animal, that gazelle, can run faster than the lion, but it was frozen in fear. And I think that's what happens to a lot of us as believers, because we're not part of community, because we don't have, I read a thing this morning on Instagram from Lisa Whittle, where she said, your heart can love everyone, but not everyone can get in your car. Mm-hmm. You know, that we need to have those few people, you know, a few girls, a few safe sisters, safe brothers, who know us well enough to ask how we're doing and know when we're not telling the truth. But I wanted to ask you, you know, I know how much time and energy you put into writing. You've helped me writing my books. You've helped so many other people. It's very intentional with you. So when you finished this book, how did that feel for you?
Well, it felt like closing a part of my life that I wanted to close. I was ready for it to close. You know, the book ends with that moment where I'm standing in my closet and looking at my wedding ring. And I just kept thinking, I don't know what to do with my wedding ring. I didn't want to take it off, and yet it was time. And so a few weeks before that, I'd been given, a friend of mine from college had found in an old box of books that she was going through from college. I hadn't seen her in 30 years. And she found my childhood Bible. I have no idea how my childhood Bible got put in a box of her college books, but somehow she had it. And she figured out a way to give it to this person who gave it to this person who eventually it made its way to me. And it was fascinating to open it up and read things written in my childhood handwriting. But some of those statements that I'd written as a child were so profound that it was almost like I was back then writing messages to myself today. And one of the things I had written in my little girl handwriting was, God would never want you to be married to a husband who loves more than you, more women than you. And God doesn't want your heart to be divided toward him either. And so I had it open to that page. And so I took my wedding ring and I tucked it in the pages of that childhood Bible. And I closed it and I put it high on a shelf in my closet. And I thought, this is just really like two bookends of my life. One, a little girl who had so many hopes and dreams for what her life would look like. And then now, my 50-year-old self, and life doesn't look at all like I thought it would, but there are parts of my life that look so much better than I would have ever envisioned. And there are parts that, you know, are part of my story, but it's not my whole story. And then there's still a lot of life to look forward to. And so I just remember putting my ring there and knowing I don't want to close this and put it away yet until I can authentically say goodbye without good riddance. And so I thought of my ex-husband, and the original word goodbye, it started off as God be with ye. That was the original meaning of goodbye. And then it was shortened to God, good, be, Y-E, and then it was shortened to just goodbye. And so then I just stood there, and with sorrow and with newfound hope, both in my heart, and I can carry both. I wanted to say goodbye, goodbye. God be with you, goodbye.
That is profound. I want to ask you, would you pray for our viewers, for people who are leaning closer to the television set because everything you're sharing is touching them deeply?
Well, let me speak first to our listeners. I want to say, I would imagine in whatever you're walking through today, whether your circumstances are like mine or not, the sorrow, the undercurrent of sorrow is the same. And I know what it feels like. I know what it feels like to wake up and want to feel the joy of the morning, but feel the dread of the day. I know what it feels like to look at your life and think, you know, I have hope for my future, but today feels so scary. I just don't know how to get through today. I know what that feels like. And I just want to remind you, you're not alone, and that there are more people and more resources out there to help you than you've got problems. So don't sit alone. Don't get in isolation, like you were saying, Sheila. And just remember that there are others out there, and there are resources that can help you, so take advantage of that. All right, let me pray. Lord, I just pray right now for the woman that is listening, or for the man that is listening, who feels as though all hope has been lost. I pray that you would give them a glimpse today of just one evidence of your goodness and your faithfulness. Maybe it's just the warmth of the sun on their face, or maybe it's an unexpected smile from a stranger, or maybe, Lord, it's running into someone who says something profound to us that we weren't expecting. Whatever it is, Lord, I pray that we would become, even in the middle of our sorrow, that we would become a noticer of your goodness and your faithfulness, because when we notice your goodness and we notice your faithfulness, we are reminded that you are right here with us. So Lord, give us that. And that can be the joy and the hope that we hold on to for today. As long as we know you're with us, then we are not alone. And when you are with us, Lord, good is there as well. In your holy name we pray, amen.